Wherever you are, we welcome you. Wherever you come from, we welcome you. Whomever you love, we welcome you. My name is Lori McGee, and it is my privilege to serve as worship associate for today's service. I am joined today by Lisa Teal, who is going to lead our service. We are delighted to welcome you to this religious community. In addition to asking you to turn off your cell phones, I would like to direct your attention to the thread from the web. This is, can be now found outside on the table. It has important announcements, as well as a calendar of events for the week ahead in the church. We are changing our practice of inserting these into the order of service in an effort to save paper. So those of you that get the e-news will see the same information, but if you would like a printed copy, it is right outside on the table.
We light our chalice this morning as a symbol of the growth that is possible when we look honestly at ourselves and engage in consistent spiritual practice.
Today, we are thrilled to witness the dedication of a child welcomed by parents who hold a very special place in all of our hearts. The arrival of this child culminates a long period of frustrations, disappointments, extreme patience, and hopeful dreams for Reverend Melissa and Reverend Evan. They have pursued parenthood with thoughtful intention and unwavering dedication. We honor the persistence and effort that they have demonstrated throughout their long journey. Come, let us celebrate together in the spirit of gratitude and promise.
By what name is this child known?
Rylan Alexander Carville Zemer.
Rylan Alexander Carville Zemer, we name you as your parents have named you. May you always know who you are and that you are loved.
Melissa and Evan have dedicated themselves to their son. Today, they make those private commitments public by sharing with us their promises.
Rylan, we are so grateful that we get to be your parents. We promise that we will do our very best to give you a safe, happy, and healthy childhood.
While you are still small, we promise to teach you that it is safe to trust in this life.
And as you grow, we promise to teach you how to heal when that trust is broken.
We love who you are. Your delight in music and climbing and dogs and books brings us such joy in our lives.
We promise to pay attention to your interests and to help you grow in heart, mind, body, and spirit. We love your curiosity and your sense of enthusiasm and adventure. We promise to nurture these by encouraging you to explore the wonders of the world.
We promise to temper our worries for you enough to let you take risks, to climb trees, ride bicycles, and build fires. As much as we delight in your babyhood and will delight in your childhood, we promise to remember that in your future lies all the responsibilities of adulthood, and therefore we will let you test your independence, give you honest answers to your questions, and opportunities to learn real-world skills.
We promise that we'll be your guides and your teachers, and we also promise to listen and learn from what you have to share. Most of all, we promise that we'll stay rooted in love and let love be our guide.
As members and friends of this congregation, we too have a share in this dedication. Will you recommit yourselves to the vision of a religious community in which all children are welcome and promise to do your part in the creation of a world in which all children may thrive? If so, you pledge, please say, we will.
We will.
Rylan, you are precious. On this day of dedication, we offer you blessings so that you may always remember that you are a blessing. I bless you with water, the universal blood which nourishes and sustains all living forms of creation. May you enjoy good health, well-being of spirit, and personal growth. I bless you with earth, symbolizing that which anchors your feet safely on the foundation of all that you will come to value. May you find strength and guidance from your family and friends, and a spiritual life that serves as the source of your grounding. I bless you with fire, the essential element that wraps you with warmth and safety. May you know fire in your heart, kindling your passions. May you know fire in your mind, igniting your quest for knowledge. And may you know fire in your hands, sparking your desire to help others. And I bless you with air, an invisible yet powerful force. May you take flight and soar wherever your spirit leads you, engaging opportunity and possibility. May you delight in the spirit of creativity and adventure. And I offer you a rose, representing beauty and vitality. Like the rose, may gentleness offset the prick of life's thorns. As the soft petals of your life unfold, may they hold beauty, mystery, and promise.
And finally, we all bless Rylan with our voices. Will you please rise in body or spirit as we speak together the words of blessing that are printed in your order of service? Rylan Alexander, we welcome you. May you never unlearn your sweet gentleness. May you win no victory which harms either yourself or another. May you keep tame that which ranges dangerous within us all. May you ask for forgiveness openly and grant it often. May you respect yourself and envy none, remembering always who you are. May you know good teachers all the days of your lives, honoring their vision, walking forward in their name. May you feel compassion for all living things, and by your actions lessen the tides of human sorrow. May you abide always in trust, resting in the spirit of life that embraces us all. May you sing your heart's own song, knowing the great joy, great peace, and great love. Amen.
Rylan, may you always know that you are a child of the universe, a child of this loving community, and a child embraced by the warm, wide circle of family. You are loved.
These are words by Mary Oliver from The Uses of Sorrow. Someone I loved once gave me a box of darkness. It took me years to understand that this too was a gift. So I'd like us to spend just a couple of moments centering together. So if you'd like to close your eyes or maybe just cast a soft gaze down to the space in front of you. Just watch your breath. So on your exhale, we're releasing carbon dioxide, and along with that, let's release anything that we're holding on to that's not serving us. Anything you had to do to get here this morning, maybe old, unhealthy habits and attitudes, just watch them ride out on the exhalation. And then on the inhale, with each inhale, bringing fresh oxygen, new healthy habits, attitudes, and inhaling ourselves more fully into the present. We'll sit in silence for just a few moments.
Each week when we gather for worship, we set aside time to widen the caring ministry of this congregation. We take time to memorialize those who have died, to celebrate with those who are joyous, and to call into this community of care all who need our love and support. Will you please hold in your hearts Renee Zimelis-Rohutsky and all of her family? Renee's father, John Zimelis, passed away earlier this week. And also please hold in your hearts Bev Cole, who is continuing to recover at the Maplewood Care Center. Our prayer this morning is a collaborative prayer that I have adapted from a prayer by Carrie Mueller. There will be a pause in part of the prayer, and you will be directed as to what to say. Spirit of life, we are joined today in a moment of gratitude for a perfect fall day, for a last blaze of sunshine in a sapphire sky before the rain and snow, for gold and crimson leaves before we are mired in piles of slush, for the moment of peace and contemplation in which to appreciate this rare beauty. This moment of perfection sharpens our love for an imperfect world. We are reminded of the many people in the world who are burdened by life's disappointments, by pain and loss. We pause this morning to share our concern and care, especially for the people in our lives who are burdened by. May they find comfort and peace, and may their burdens be lifted from them. May we find it in ourselves today to work toward a better world. We are energized by the beauty of the day. May we make use of that energy to take part in the lifting of burdens. May our gratitude find expression in the care of others, both near and far. May we find ways to bless the world. Amen.
This poem is called Love Dogs. It's written by a 13th century Sufi mystic, Jalal al-Din Muhammad Rumi, otherwise known as Rumi. One night, a man was crying, "Allah, Allah." His lips grew sweet with the praising, until a cynic said, "So, I have heard you calling out, but have you ever gotten any response?" The man had no answer to that. He quit praying and fell into a confused sleep. He dreamed he saw Kadir, the guide of souls, in a thick green foliage. "Why did you stop praising?" "Because I've never heard anything back." "This longing you express is the return message. The grief you cry out from draws you toward union. Your pure sadness that wants help is the secret cup. Listen to the moan of a dog for its master. That whining is the connection. There are love dogs no one knows the names of. Give your life to be one of them." All right, I'm going to start off by having you close your eyes again, and if you'd rather not, cast a soft gaze down in front of you. And I'd like you to try and think of an experience that happened recently that made you feel really uncomfortable. Maybe you ran into a friend who told you that her child has just been diagnosed with a very serious illness, and it's your turn to speak. Maybe an accident you witnessed that you can't seem to get out of your mind. Or perhaps a confrontation of some sort. Somebody called you on something you really hoped no one would notice, and you're not quite ready to own up to it. Or any other situation you can think of that made you deeply uncomfortable. So try and really enter that experience and see if you can observe your own reactions, your instincts, What's your first inclination? To remove yourself from that situation as fast as possible? To try and escape from your own mind temporarily? You might change the subject, find a way to make a joke, start randomly humming, turn the music up really loud, or go eat something. Let food or drink fill that space or cover that unpleasant feeling inside of you. Or shopping. Buy something new for yourself or the home, or just quickly turn your thoughts back to something that makes you happy. You can open your eyes now if you'd like. I'm pretty sure that we all have our tendencies. They might not be the examples I've cited, but those things that we use to protect ourselves from feeling pain, or not so much pain even as mild discomfort, those things we do to distract and numb ourselves. I'm going to tell you a little bit about my MO, my method of operation, which, well, I've had lots of them, but I'm just going to share two. First, early on, I became a fixer. Whatever the problem was, I'd simply find a way to make it all better as quickly as possible. I'm smart. I can solve problems. Let's get this situation back to where everything's hunky-dory, all feels good and comfortable, and everyone's happy. There's no tension in the air, no heaviness. And second, I decided, well, rather unconsciously decided, not to feel at all. I cut myself off from the heart and lived solely in my head, rationalizing and intellectualizing everything. It's much easier not to feel any pain, mine or somebody else's, and really, there's not a whole lot of difference. Feeling someone else's pain triggers your own. So I build up some strong defenses to keep from knowing anyone else too deeply and to keep them from knowing me. I also steered clear of heart-centered people entirely. They're just too scary, too risky, and too vulnerable. So there I remained blissfully ignorant for a long, long time, but like most life lessons, we get a bunch of little experiences that start planting seeds and trying to draw our attention, and then a few really big ones that kind of slap you in the face to make sure you get the message. Well, I've had a lot of the slaps, but I'm just going to share a couple of those. So one was my first trip to the beautiful and glorious, but also harsh and somewhat scary country of India. I was quite unprepared for the intensity of the poverty, the population, crowdedness that you can't even imagine. Everywhere I looked were crowds and crowds of people going about their lives amidst a ceaseless cacophony of horns, competing smells, yelling street hawkers, beggars with missing limbs, pleading desperately for some rupees, burning corpses, and other things we don't normally have to see, and the sheer unpredictability of, well, everything. You might have running water today, rolling brownouts as the electricity goes off for an indeterminate amount of time just when you need it most, train schedules, well, nothing happens as planned. For somebody from a middle-class family growing up in the neat, clean, predictable suburbs, this was a very influential few weeks for me. And I never thought of myself as a comfort seeker. I don't live extravagantly, and those of you who know me, I know that I'm not fancy at all. And, well, I'm sure there are exceptions, but I think for the most part, when we're hungry, we find something to eat. When we're cold, we turn the thermostat up. If it rains, park in the attached garage. When bored, we fill the space in innumerable ways. And if somebody makes us feel uncomfortable, we move away from them. And try and make sure that doesn't happen again, even. The list is infinite. So I was intensely struck by the calm determination of the people of India. And, you know, I don't know that it was so much a spiritual practice as simple practicality. When you have no option of making the discomfort go away, you just forge ahead. And think about it. How often do we do that? How often versus how often we assuage our discomforts and how rapidly? So I had another powerful experience around that same time as a friend of mine was dying of cancer. I spent a fair amount of time with him during that last year and especially his last few months. And this was clearly one of those situations that could not be fixed. There was no right thing to say, no matter how strong this instinct was in me to say, everything will be all right. And as much as I wanted to run from that situation and get back to the world of the living and put those mortal thoughts out of my mind, I kept up with these visits for him, or so I thought. What turned out to be the case was that he gave me a gift I'll never forget. He handled his illness with such grace and acceptance. It was through these visits I began learning how to simply be, without fixing, without running, without numbing or distracting, to just be. And I experienced for the first time what I've since come to call the pain of presence. So what's the problem with distracting and numbing ourselves? Is there any need to be any different? What's wrong with chasing pleasant feelings, avoiding the unpleasant? What's wrong with being happy all the time? Well, the research writer in me has come up with four reasons. One, it's simply not practical. It's not realistic. We live in a constantly changing world. What goes up must come down. And we have a saying in the yoga world, change is the nature of nature. And in order to have any living, vibrant system, there must be movement, not stagnation. And yet our culture tends to, as a whole, overemphasize feeling good and making bad things go away. One recent example, I was looking for a children's book for today's service, and I thought I would just get this big old stack from the library and pick the one with the best pictures and texts that were just perfect. And I found countless ones advising kids on how to feel better. And really only one, like this today, that encourages them to accept a range of emotions that come and go. And, well, consider the bombardment of buy-this-feel-good advertisements. And if you spend any time at all on Facebook, you see a whole lot of perfect happy, perfect families, perfectly brilliant, angelic, well-adjusted children saying just the right thing at all times, perfect marriages, lots and lots of idyllic vacations. And you know that saying that's been common over the last couple decades, it's all good. That's a bit of an illusion. It's not all good. Is there any place where only light exists and not shadow? Number two, we're limiting ourselves, cheating ourselves of the full experience of life, of the wholeness that is our birthright. You know how a lot of churches have those signs out front and they try and outdo each other with the catchiest slogans each week? Well, I passed one a while ago that said, all good things come from God. And my first thought was, oh, that's sweet. And then I thought, wait a minute, the whole world comes from God. All things come from God, right? Aren't we fooling ourselves to think that only good things matter? Doesn't that keep us chasing a partial experience? In the sacred Indian text, the Isa Upanishad, it is said, if you worship dark, you end up in darkness. If you worship light, you end up in darkness. I believe that in order to feel a sense of wholeness, we must embrace both light and shadow. And when we don't, we condition ourselves to identify with components, our pieces, parts. I think that what happens is that whatever situation or feeling is in front of us at any given time, that's what we identify with. That partial experience becomes us. And so it sort of makes sense that we want us to be the good and the happy. But we're going to play around with this a little bit. I don't have a lot of time, but in your order of service, there's a wheel of awareness on a half sheet of paper, and there's a smattering of pens under and in front of you, and kind of put them everywhere. Hopefully you can find a pen. There's one under you, Melissa, right there. They're all over the chair. It's a very wobbly wheel. Everybody found it? Okay. So I'm going to have you just put your name in the center circle or draw a picture of your face or a symbol something that symbolizes you. So you're right in that center spoke, your name or your picture. And then around the edge in the wheel or else in between the spoke sections, wherever you prefer, I'm going to put... You can take a few different approaches. You might put the range of emotions you've experienced in the last week, like the book that we had this morning, or different aspects of your personality, just maybe different things that you do, maybe some things other people have told you about yourself. Just have a nice smattering of aspects of you and your life. And just start to notice if it gets a little lopsided. So try and have the good and the bad, or maybe not bad, the good and the less good, however you want to look at it, in the sections around there. We'll just take about a half a minute. All right, so when you look at your wheel, you can kind of fill it in mentally if you're not done. You can see that these are all just aspects, components that make up one big whole. And when we do practices like these, we start to train ourselves in objectivity. We begin to get a sense of the bigger picture and ideally become like the bird that flies above the trees and can see the whole forest, can see our wholeness, get a glimpse of our wholeness. Reason number three, that we should not just chase happy comfort and run from all else. We dull down or obscure our awareness. However much we may trick ourselves into thinking these shadows don't exist, they're still there, guiding us without our knowledge. Consider these words by Buddhist teacher Yonge Mingyur Rinpoche. Ultimately, happiness comes down to choosing between the discomfort of becoming aware of your mental afflictions and the discomfort of being ruled by them. Happiness comes down to the discomfort of being aware of our mental afflictions and the discomfort of being ruled by them. So if those are your two choices, then which is preferable? It's certainly better to be in the driver's seat. And one way I've found useful in training my own awareness is pause, breathe, notice. Before reacting, before speaking, I try and catch the first signs of wanting to speak a little too quickly or that strong urge to remove myself from a situation, any knee-jerk reactions, especially when it comes out as blaming somebody else or defending myself. Pause, breathe, notice. What am I trying to push away? So I might be making it sound easier than it is. It takes a lot of effort. It's called spiritual practice, right? So just a few days ago, I had an interesting little experience. I thought the sermon was all completed, wrapped up in a neat and tidy bow, and I started this new novel by an author I tend to really like, and a few chapters in, I was thinking, oh, wow, I have a lot in common with this protagonist, this middle-aged, white, suburban mother of a teen dealing with some of the same issues, the same questions. And then soon it became really clear where the story was going. Something profoundly sad was going to happen, and I just didn't want to feel it. At the time, I didn't think clearly about it. I put the book down and just went back to the library to get another book. And about an hour later, I thought, wow, isn't that interesting? So several Eastern philosophical systems have this idea of self-study related to attraction and aversion, the desire for things that make us happy and the avoidance of things that make us unhappy. Buddhist nun Pema Chodron teaches a useful exercise. She suggests walk down the street, even just one city block, with the intention of staying as awake as possible to whomever or whatever you meet. This is training in being emotionally honest with ourselves. As we pass people, we simply notice whether we open up or shut down. We notice if we feel attraction, aversion, or indifference without adding any self-judgment. Noticing where we open up and shut down is the basis of our practice, and it can be a real eye-opener if you stay present and willing to see what arises. Another exercise I've found useful is fasting. By setting parameters of not taking food for a day, or even a modest fast of just taking fruit, some kind of limitation, and noticing what comes up, how many times I reach for food without thinking, and how quickly, how unconsciously I ease even the slightest feelings of hunger, the slightest hunger. Another practice, it's helpful but sometimes excruciating, is to think of a person you really dislike, a person that you see showing up on caller ID that makes your whole body tense up, maybe a difficult member of the extended family. These are great teachers, opportunities to ask ourselves, why do we feel this way around this person? What can we learn about ourselves? What is this person triggering in me? And finally, reason number four, why we shouldn't just chase the good and avoid the unpleasant. Purification opportunities. This makes me think of a t-shirt I once saw. It said, oh no, not another learning opportunity.
I found that as much as I have avoided the heart, avoided feeling, it is truly those moments where I have been the most raw, the most emotionally vulnerable, that have absolutely led to the greatest growth and healing for me, that have borne the sweetest fruit. Those moments that Ram Dass calls the grist for the mill, or the sand that along with the friction creates the beautiful shiny pearl. One of the foundational practices of yoga is tapas, or austerity, or internal fire. It's one of the five niyamas, or personal observances, in the Yoga Sutras. Tapas is the heat that's created in us when we challenge ourselves in a way that can lead toward healing. And through this internal fire, if we maintain a keen awareness, we work towards burning away the seeds of that which keeps us from being content. There are lots of examples. I'm sure you can all think of a ton. I'm going to just share a couple. I recently caught a TED Talks episode with Eve Ensler. You might know her, the writer of the Vagina Monologues. In this talk, she gave the world a glimpse of her childhood trauma, being raised with violence and sexual abuse. And as a result, she grew up disconnected from her body. "I was nothing but a head," she says. And as an adult, when she learned that she had advanced uterine cancer, she was led on a journey of disbelief, anger, and eventually an invitation to inhabit her body for the first time, to be fully present, to live her life consciously and completely. In one of my favorite books of all times, called Waking, A Memoir of Trauma and Transcendence, Matthew Sanford tells the story of his family's car accident that took the lives of his father and sister, leaving him paraplegic. As I was reading the details, I remember thinking to myself, okay, there's no way this guy can come around after this horrific experience. I mean, this is as bad as it gets. Through many long struggles and unimaginable suffering, physically, mentally, emotionally, Sanford finds a way to make peace with his situation, but then also he was propelled onto a spiritual path that led him to becoming one of the most inspiring yoga teachers the whole global yoga community has ever known. A paraplegic teacher who guides yoga students on how to be present with their own bodies and minds to practice contentment, peace, and healing. Or for a less dramatic example, my fix-it-don't-feel approach. My drive to fix was me chasing the permanency of the it's-all-good feeling. And let me just add that I didn't see it. It was so unconscious to me until a friend and teacher started pointing it out. So there was my option of the discomfort of being aware of my afflictions or the discomfort of being ruled by them. And living in my head was a way to avoid all pain and discomfort, but it kept me also from feeling much of anything, including the fullness of life, the glory of the present moment, for which there's no substitute and in which lives the divine. And I'm sure the work's just beginning, and sometimes I know that all I can really do is just show up. But if I continually employ my awareness and a willingness to be honest, patient, persistent, courageous, the practice will gradually bring a greater and greater sense of wholeness. I'd like to bring you into a very, very brief moment of silence, a brief guided meditation. So if you just set your things down, rest your hands in your lap, rest your feet on the floor, close the eyes or look down at the floor. And just start to notice any sensation at all, anything. It might be a little itch in the corner of your mouth. Maybe some desire to fidget. Maybe a leg is starting to fall asleep. Or maybe we're just uncomfortable with the practice. Just notice and allow every sensation that appears. And know that soon you can make them all go away, but for right now, we're going to observe and allow it. And let's go ahead and deepen the breath and just blink your eyes a little, start to bring yourself back to the room. Thank you. As you go forth, may you remember these words by Rumi. Our defects are the ways that glory gets manifested. Whosoever sees clearly what's diseased in himself begins to gallop on the way. Don't turn your head. Keep looking at the bandaged place. That's where the light enters you.